Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcast. This is podcast 453. I think I'm going to do the second installment of my new thinking series. And I'm going to entitle this The New Faceless Tyranny, The State. And that is what we're going to talk about in this podcast. Well, I heard something the other day that actually scared me, and it was a weather forecast, and it said that we're going to get a polar vortex in the upper Midwest in about a week or so, and it'll warm up after that, and then we're going to have another polar vortex, and it's coming just on the weekend that the Vikings are playing Seattle, and so, you know, the Vikings this year are playing outside while we build them this fabulous stadium, and so lots of people are kind of excited about the potential for the Vikings to beat Seattle this weekend. But here's the thing. We've got this seesaw weather where it gets cold and then it gets warm and it gets cold. And that could mean plumbing problems, especially if you have pipes that freeze and pipes that thaw. A couple of years ago, my neighbors had a problem with freezing pipes next door, and it was not because of anything they did. It was because of a frozen connection out in the street, and it was crazy. So first of all, you should have your heating and your plumbing checked by Ryan Plumbing and Heating. That's the first thing. Second thing, when and if you have emergency problems this winter, remember Ryan Plumbing and Heating. Here are the numbers. In Minneapolis, you can call 612-927-6488. In St. Paul, 651-224-4771. Ryan Plumbing goes metro-wide. So if you live in Invergrove Heights or if you live in Plymouth, they are all over the place, and they're ready with quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems if you need it. And they do emergencies, and they do a lot of emergency service. Ryan Plumbing and Heating is on University Avenue in St. Paul, just west of the state capitol. They've always been there. In fact, I was over there the other day. And finally saw the Ryan Plumbing and Heating World Headquarters. And in St. Paul, you can call them at 651-224-4771. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Remember, when it comes to keeping all of these systems running in really good condition, especially when it is super cold, and especially when you have this seesaw weather, remember Ryan Plumbing and Heating when you want reliable service. 651-224-4771 in St. Paul. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. And thanks, Greg Ryan, for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcasts. To preface this podcast, I'm going to say that, again, I am frustrated with the choices that I have currently for things to talk about. So tonight, continuing in sort of my new excitement phase about the political process, I have continued to pull stories, you know, print them up and read them. Now, I don't need to go in long and involved detail that this is what I do, but I used to make little piles of stories of like mind. So if a bunch of stories went together, I'd make a little pile, and then I'd make another pile and another pile, and then, you know, I would line them up and then build them into segments for the radio show. So I thought, you know, I'm going to do what I would have done if I was still going to do a show in the morning. And so I just wanted to see what I had. And, you know, boy, it makes me glad that I don't have to do a radio show in the morning. But then I thought, well, then what kind of a podcast are you going to do? Because the choice is I'm going to take all these, the Bundy story, the president's executive orders on firearms, the stuff about the British trying to pass a resolution to keep Trump out, the other, you know, the usual collection of the usual stories. And I thought, I'm just going to talk about my reaction to this stuff in some kind of organized fashion that I call new thinking. And I'm going to start by simply saying that what I see, the thread that kind of runs through all of these stories, is something that you hear all the time. And we hear it from both ends of the political spectrum in America. It's kind of hard to see it for what it is if you're a partisan on either side. So if you're on the left or the right, it's hard to see these kinds of demands that something needs to be done or to do something right now. When you're on the other side of the political spectrum, whether it is do something about poverty, do something about presidential overreach, do something about guns, do something about fill in the blank with your pet partisan issue. And I see, this is my point about how it's hard to see it when somebody else is doing it, but usually your partisanship you know, which faction or tribe that you belong to is revealed in the demands that people make on a specific branch of government. Usually, if it's a Republican president, it will be the Republicans demanding that the president do something, and they will tend to overlook executive overreach among Republicans. If it's a Democrat, they will be demanding that the Democrat president do something. There are a congressional majority of Democrats, the Democrats will demand that Congress does something, and vice versa when it's Republicans. The courts, depending on the case and challenge, will be encouraged to vote one way or another, especially the Supreme Court, when people are out in front of the court protesting for this, that, or the other thing. And it produces, because the courts feel political pressure, even though they claim that they don't, it produces artifacts like, you know, minority judges, for example, being really upset about the ruling on same-sex marriage and demanding that the court reverse it or whatever. So you see a lot of hypocrisy in politics these days. You see a lot of hypocrisy in the day-to-day news and the way people talk about it. For example, limited government types who will turn around at the drop of a hat and demand that stadiums be financed by tax money or that we reinstate the draft because everybody should experience the joys of military service and the responsibilities of military service, or people who balk at the elimination of government employees unions and say that they are believers in limited government. Or you hear demands to break up the banks by politicians of all stripes who voted for the bailouts, which saved the big banks. See what I mean? When we ask the government to do something, we're usually asking for some kind of unilateral action, which reflects a level of frustration with some special interest or faction that we don't agree with. And so we're asking various areas of our government to overreach. So often, we want a government power used to cauterize a factional development for some other exercise of government power that this seems to be something that's covered on a day-to-day basis. And sometimes the news coverage doesn't even identify it as an overreach. You have to kind of figure it out. Now, the founders were deeply concerned about political factions, partisan groups, and the ability of these factions to tear apart the fabric of our society. And they built a system that was supposed to address that. So I can't tell from my vantage point whether this is the way it's always been, whether it's worse than it's ever been, or it's not as bad as it was in previous times. It's hard for me to tell, so I'm not going to say. You know, part of this podcast was, you know, directed at this issue, and I'm reluctant to say it's the worst it's ever been because I don't know. I didn't live in the 1780s. I didn't live in the 1850s. You know, I didn't live in the 1920s. For years, people who call themselves conservatives worried about factions on the left that touted Marxist economic theory, and these days the factions that tout Northern European economic models, such as they are, as factions to be afraid of. Conversely, over the years, the left has feared all sorts of factions on the right, big business, small business, gun toters, and religious people or people that carry around don't tread on me flags. Politicians and courts have had to work out the differences, usually, I suppose on balance, usually fairly well, but sometimes not so well. Sometimes politicians have done it on the basis of their constituencies, courts supposedly on the basis of law and constitution, but sometimes based on political concerns and sometimes based on a desire to overreach or to solve a problem because the legislatures won't, because they're unable to come to an agreement and we don't have the patience to wait for them to come to an agreement. But here we are in a country that has a written constitution and a Bill of Rights, which binds federal and state governments to protect the rights of the citizen. So in that, and with that notwithstanding, we do see the growth of state power. We see it in what I see, and this is one of the stories I was looking at this week. We see it in the formation and functioning of these unelected bodies, councils, working groups, the members of which influence policy directly or indirectly, sometimes with really negative results. A good example, and probably the Rosetta Stone of this kind of commission, is the Federal Reserve. Another one is working groups of the United Nations with their various agendas and environmental panels that agencies and city councils and state governments sign on to through votes or not. Regional development panels like the Met Council in Minneapolis and St. Paul area, which is not elected. Cabals of businessmen who meet in secret, such as in Minneapolis and St. Paul, again, this group called the Itasca Group, which was written up glowingly in the New York Times as, thank God this group exists to act outside the jurisdiction of the purveyance of state legislatures or the executive branch in the state. Or perhaps groups like the Bilderberger Group. If you're a conspiracist, you can add your own to the list with the following qualifications. It can't be a public organization. It has to have members who are appointed, usually by governors or presidents. It has to operate in relative secrecy without public meetings anyone can attend. I think the danger is we are seeing publicity that indicates this is the preferred way of doing things. You know, this is how the nobility did things in ancient times in Britain. And this was what started, one of the things that started the whole liberty debate were these councils of cardinals and nobility that made decisions for individuals. Sometimes, and they also believed the sovereignty resided in the monarch or the nobility. So this is something that we fought for in America, that our founders fought for, this idea that sovereignty resides in the people and not in these unelected councils. Now, sometimes the reason for these panels to exist is a stated need to meet, to research, and to recommend policy that I suppose is okay, that would otherwise be interrupted by public processes and the interference of special interest political groups. But at least special interest political groups like the Chamber of Commerce are public, and people understand the workings of those groups. Moreover, the policies these groups recommend isn't connected to assessments of potential profits by individuals who are on these committees or have something to do with an appointment on those committees. They're not controlled by any ethics rules or regulations, and they are not open to the public. So the public has no idea what their deliberations are. So the voter then is disconnected from the deliberation process, and there are no counterbalances to the actions recommended or taken by these kinds of unelected councils. What is the counterbalance? For example, the countervailing power in the case of an urban planning council with authority over individual towns or villages, or the Federal Reserve, or a council that has complete authority over sewers, roads, transit, and so forth. What's the counterbalance to a United Nations plan for community development standardization that villages and towns have to sign on to in order to get federal funding for some projects, or states that are forced to enact certain kinds of legislation in order to get federal funding, or states that take federal funding for projects and then turn around to their citizens, which are taxed to provide that funding, and say, hey, we're not going to be able to do A, B, or C unless we have that, we're going to get this money anyway. So if we don't spend the money, we won't get the money. See what I'm saying? There's no control of the citizen over that process. Then there are these agencies of the executive branch, whether it is the governor's office or the presidency, whether it's the Department of Transportation and Education, the environmental protection agencies at the federal and state level, treasury departments, Department of the Interior, and so on. These agencies claim to have the power of life and death over their subjects, usually supported by the courts. In other words, they bring their power to the citizen at the point of a gun. Hence that slogan, that phrase, you know, they're going to come to me at the point of a gun and say, you have to pay your tax. A great example is playing out right now with the sentencing and jailing of ranchers in Oregon and the takeover of a federal structure on federal land in the same county by activists. Doesn't matter which side you're on, this process is playing out as we speak. Finally, loose interpretation of executive authority, such as using the IRS to persecute certain political groups, which is now known. And it wasn't just Obama. Obama is only the latest example. Johnson and Nixon both used the IRS to try to suppress opposition to their administrations. Executive actions, which are usually subject to congressional reaction and the interpretation of some of the courts for various imperatives to do something. I should say that sometimes they are subjected to some congressional reaction, but is in the case of Obama's recent executive orders on firearms, there's really not much Congress can do about some of it, or other than not vote funding for some of the initiatives that are listed in his effort. So whether it is that type of thing, there are usually reactions to imperatives from someone to do something, whether it's on trade, arms negotiation, military action, or most recently in the present time frame, guns. We're freaking out about guns. And in history, we have had federal intervention and persecutions and incidents like Ruby Ridge and Waco, but also Wounded Knee. Or on the other hand, we had the federalized National Guard and federalized troops brought into cities in southern United States to enforce both Reconstruction and to enforce civil rights law. So sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad, and it gives rise to all kinds of rhetoric by candidates who declare that they're going to rescind certain executive orders. And here's the catch. I've noticed this just recently. I will, the day one, I will rescind these constitutionally questionable or unconstitutional or illegal executive orders by the previous president. The problem with that is that's a caveat, because what happens if the president decides that he's going to rescind an executive order and somebody says, oh, wait, Mr. President, that actually might end up working well for you because you can use that same executive order to do A, B, or C, and your constituents want that. And then he'll come out and say, well, the question of whether it's unconstitutional is really got to be figured out. So it's going to be a while before we rescind that particular executive order. So they'll go out and say all kinds of things, but there's always a caveat. There's always an out as to whether they're going to do it. Or you'll have politicians declaring that they're going to fight for this initiative or that initiative, usually directed at a faction that believes one thing or another that has to be done right now. I mean, that's politics. But usually, obviously, any one state representative or state senator or federal congressman or senator is going to go there and they're going to fight for something, which means they're going to have to make deals and they're going to have to go to meetings and they're going to have to try to get into leadership and so on and so on. And it just keeps going. If the cumulative total of all these actions, which are reactions to demands of factions, add up to a sort of creeping tyranny, you know, we need to have the power to get something done if you want something done, well, then what are we to do? Well, you've heard me talking about exgovernmentcars.com, and so now I'm proud to announce, this is not a new announcement, it's been on for a while, Ex-Government Trucks is now open in Forest Lake. Yes, Ex-Government Trucks is now open at 356 19th Street in Forest Lake. If you want to, you can call 763-777-8782, or I would just go online and check out exgovernmenttrucks.com. The new Ex-Government Trucks Mega Truck Center features dozens of the best brands for Ford, Chevy, Dodge, Toyotas, and more fleet-maintained government vehicles that are actually amazing when you see them. And you can drive right through the location and snake through and see what they've got. Ex-Government Trucks has lending for everyone at all credit levels. They can get you approved fast. Here's what you do. You find your vehicle, then you apply online for fast pre-approval, and you're good to go. Ex-Government Trucks also continues the Ex-Government Car 3-day peace of mind guarantee, so you buy with confidence. And as always, they love trades. Ed is always telling me, tell people that we take trades and we pay the highest values without a lot of the crap that you often get when you're shopping for cars. So get your butt down to exgovernmenttrucks.com today, 356 19th Street in Forest Lake.
Exgovernmenttrucks.com.
So I've suggested that we need a new kind of thinking. I think we have to change our expectations of what the government is doing and what it's supposed to do, what we think it is doing and what we think it's supposed to do. And it has to be a framework that lifts our eyes up above the day-to-day news stories, above the horizon of these stories, which are really designed to generate outrage, and gets us thinking more in an analytical way at a higher level, whether something is actually a threat to our liberty or not. For example, there's a bunch of them in today's headlines. Is there an epidemic of mass shootings in the United States? Because I've seen studies that incorporate terror attacks as mass shootings. you know, the legal action taken to address a mass shooting is different from the legal action taken to address a terror shooting, even though the results are the same. But the president says there's an epidemic of mass shootings. Is there? I mean, I don't carry around all the shooting statistics in my head, but I do know one thing. I know that the assembly and discussion and collation and analysis of crime statistics is a fine art that partisans have practiced for many years. How do local communities solve their transportation issues? Do we need to have a train? Does that solve a local transportation issue, or can we solve it with a road? Depending on the faction, they will produce studies and tell you we have to have the train because it's going to do this, that, or the other thing. And you've heard me do podcasts all about that because it started out to be this is going to take cars off the road, and now it's a development tool over the years because it's been proven that trains don't solve transportation issues. But it continues. We keep building them because federal funding for those projects are issued, and if you want to get the money, you have to build the train, and that's the biggest excuse in the world. Well, we've got to do this, or we're going to lose the income from the federal government. It comes out of your wallet one way or the other. Is our infrastructure locally and nationally crumbling, and how is it to be fixed? I saw a great example just recently. We live in a city where a bridge collapsed a few years ago, and we hear constantly from these politicians that the bridge collapsed and this proves we cannot have bridges falling down in America. Well, the thing is, the studies have shown that that bridge could have fallen at any time from the time that it was built in 1965 or 6 or 7 or whenever to when it finally collapsed 5 or 6 years ago. So that bridge could have collapsed at any time. It was a design error and not something related to upkeep of infrastructure. In fact, they were upkeeping the bridge. They were painting and working on the deck when it collapsed. So that's a great example of misplaced facts, but that doesn't stop them from building factions to support yet more money to be spent for things that it's hard to tell. I've mentioned many times, and I don't want to go on and on, but I've driven across the country I don't know how many times, and I don't see this crumbling infrastructure issue that everyone's talking about. Should the federal government own large swaths of land in the western states? Why does it now? I still haven't seen a credible explanation of why the federal government has purchased or has demanded or taken through eminent domain or whatever they do, why or how they have taken out large swaths of land in the West. You know, why do they own that land? Why do they want to own that land? I haven't seen a decent explanation of that other than Roosevelt declared those lands open park to protect a certain bird 100 years ago, and the federal government's been expanding on it ever since. So this issue of federal government controlling land, large swaths of lands, and herding farmers and ranchers out west is a real issue. And if you're an urban person, you look at what's going on out there and you think of them as a bunch of crazy hayseeds, you know, ideologues in cowboy hats. But do they have, you know, a credible complaint against federal government encroachment? Has the executive branch over time overstepped constitutional authority? And not just Democrats. We have a great example of a Democrat president who has been issuing a lot of executive orders because his opinion is that if Congress doesn't agree with him, he should enforce his perception of moral behavior or political reality on the country because he feels that he is supposed to do that. Well, have Republicans done that? And do we expect the next president to do the same thing, to rescind what this president has done or more, depending on which side of the political spectrum you are? Is there an example where Congress has overstepped its authority? Let's go back to the 1970s with the Church Committee hearings and the attack on the executive branch by Congress known as Watergate. Whether or not it was justified or not, whether or not Nixon overreacted to a simple investigation, Congress got pretty powerful during the 70s and early 70s and mid 70s with negative results. So we have seen the ebb and flow of branches of the government getting stronger and then being checked and back and forth. How do you define liberty and freedom? And how do you come down on these issues of these different branches of government that we watch where they're supposed to be countervailing, but it doesn't always work like a software program. Sometimes it takes a while for things to get balanced out. And if so, if that's how it works, what is the proper means for ensuring that our government does the main thing it's supposed to do, which is protect our freedoms and liberties, and maintains the balance between freedom and order, as well as the countervailing balance of power within the government. How many of us can do something about what is happening in our own communities without alienating those who might disagree with our ideas, and vice versa? So that's really a nonpartisan question. And how many of us can do it without demanding something be done by some authority greater than the people, as though there is an authority greater than the people, right? So you hear a lot about state power these days, and usually these days it's about federal power. You don't hear much about what we need to do about state power overreach, what some call tyranny. I don't mean state power as in the state of Idaho. I'm talking about state power as in the state, the federal government, the state government, the whole thing. You don't hear much about what we can do about state power overreach. This is what some people call tyranny. Now, the way this is transmitted through the political process and the media is usually through political rhetoric, people coalescing behind a presidential candidate or a cause. And that person that represents the cause or that presidential candidate is going to fix it with some kind of silver bullet. And if he or she doesn't win, you'll hear people lament, well, you know, if they had elected so-and-so, this would have not happened. And some great examples right now on the campaign trail, Bernie Sanders is going to, quote, break up the big banks. And I didn't check what his vote was on the stimulus, but I would imagine he voted for it. And I imagine he voted for the bailout. Maybe not, but I'm willing to bet that he did. Donald Trump is going to build a wall and keep the aliens out like the wall in the movie Z, right? And he's going to make Mexico pay for it. He could, maybe, but I'd be surprised if that actually happens in 4 years of a Donald Trump presidency. Ted Cruz is going to destroy ISIS. And so they're all talking about how they're going to destroy ISIS, but they don't tell you how. And I'm willing to bet that they're probably not going to be able to do that. And how much blood and treasure is going to be expended to accomplish that, you know, rhetorical goal. But people want to hear that because they want something done about ISIS because they see it on television. Ben Carson is going to enact a flat tax. He is going to enact a flat tax. And you can add more to the list, whatever they are. This one's going to fix the economy. But the thing is, the president himself is not going to fix the economy. He is going to have to get the help of Congress. He is going to have to get the help of, the courts. He is going to have to get the help of the people. He's going to have to, or she is going to have to, get the support for the initiatives that will, quote unquote, fix the economy. And one side's idea of fixing the economy is different from the others. Apparently, most people don't realize that these goals have to be accomplished with Congress, unless, of course, you want your guy to use executive orders that you deemed illegal usurpations to fix the illegal overreaches of the last guy. And the thing just grows, as I said. This is why I did a podcast suggesting that we've made the presidency way too popular, and it is covered as though he is the head coach of the local football team, or worse, a king that we elect, or a king that we're only able to check through Parliament or the House of Lords, which he, the king, who has been appointed by God, can dissolve at his or the queen's whim. The American Republic is a completely different thing. The sovereignty is in the people. In other words, the seat of government is in the people, and it took 500 years for the intellectuals and the legal minds and the leaders to come to the conclusion that the best kind of government is the kind of government where the people control, they have the seat of government, they hold the power of government. We, the people, wear the sash of sovereignty. We delegate our authority to three branches of government through elections, which are held every 2 years, local elections, which are held often, gubernatorial elections, and so forth. And the sections of our government share sovereignty and have countervailing powers, which is supposed to be checked by the states, which are again supposed to be checked by the federal government. So if there's a problem, who's responsible? Is it just the rich guys? Is it just the poorer guys who just want more handouts from the federal government, supposedly? Is it the corrupt, people who through legal means have corrupted the process by appointing councils and meeting in secret with the Itasca group in some office building downtown? Now, I've already stated that we need to learn to focus on issues rather than personalities. That's the first thing. And I think the most important thing about new thinking is if people would say, you know, let's get off the personalities box and get into the issues box and start working on issue focus so that in the process, we learn to look at concerns with detachment and we learn to debate them with detachment rather than this partisan outlook. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with being passionate about an issue. But partisan is a different thing entirely. I think our founders were passionate about issues. I don't know that they were, it has to be my way or the highway, or we're walking out and we're going to do this, that, or the other thing. And I think part of that is that we need to work with facts, and I mean known facts, rather than opinion or fact opinion or opinions designed to exacerbate disagreement, but the facts on the ground that we know about. How much do you know about ISIS? How much do you know about Islamic Jihad? How much do you know about Muslims? How much do you know about guns? I hear a lot of people that don't like guns, but they don't know much about guns. How much do you know about state power versus federal power in terms of federal lands? How much do you know about the plight of the rancher? How much does the rancher know about the plight of somebody that lives in, at 76th and Woodlawn in Chicago or the South Side? We need to work with known facts, and we need to start to understand that some facts may not support our point of view, and we have to figure out how to work with those facts. For example, the gun issue and the concern about supposedly an epidemic of mass shootings. Is there, as I said before, the media says there is, the president says there is, but it depends on how you count them and how you categorize them, you know, how you classify something called a mass shooting. Or the Federal Reserve. A lot of us want to get rid of the Federal Reserve. Okay, if we're going to make that argument, we need to understand what's going to happen when we get rid of the Federal Reserve, or if we go back to the gold standard, and how that is going to be accomplished and what the impact of it will be. And then we need to understand how it is going to get resolved and dissolved because it was established with an act of Congress. I hear this all the time. We need to get rid of the Federal Reserve. Well, how are you going to do that? Because you're going to need a majority vote of 435 congressmen. So there's a fact-gathering phase, there is a debate phase, and there is an action phase. And I think we need to learn that in the action phase, what is required is a stable and effective organization that pressures politicians, parties, special interest groups, and funding. And we need to learn that, especially for liberty advocates, that effective organization does not exist. There are lots of partisan organizations. There is lots of passionate, angry people who say things on television and put out YouTubes and expose things, but there's no organization that helps people apply political pressure, particularly on state and federal governments. We need to learn that I'm just going to say this is true of almost every political faction. The fact-gathering phase is also polluted with political influence, partisanship, and YouTube videos and stuff from Fox News, and all of it is designed to persuade. It is not designed to illuminate. And we need to understand that the debate phase has devolved then into trading insults and name-calling and demands and frustration that usually read in some way, shape, or form, somebody needs to, quote, do something, unquote. So taking action, I think, unfortunately, and for me, this is very hard to say because I'm not this kind of person. It demands cold, unemotional, and rational analysis of carefully collected facts. Debate demands rational and calm discussion of those facts and discussion that leads to a resolution that can be written down and voted on about what is really going on and what is actually possible. You don't see that very often. And then action demands political power to act on those resolutions. That's really what's missing in the process. A lot of people who think of state power today as tyranny simply don't have the ability to respond. They don't have the levers to be able to respond to things that they don't agree with. They don't have political power. And as such, they are the slaves of the rhetorical, of the artistic snake oil salesman on both ends of the political spectrum. They don't exist just on the Republican side. They exist on the Democrat side, too. Or of the seasoned party fixer, the man behind the shadows that pulls the levers and does the opposition research and destroys people that certain politicians don't agree with or certain groups of people in charge don't agree with. And so people then are forced to act in unreasonable and legally questionable ways. And sometimes they go to jail and sometimes they're killed because of it. In the end, these actions usually result in dubious gains in much the same way as Shay's Rebellion, which, you know, and others like it, which resulted in the establishment of a yet stronger central government, which is what they were upset about to begin with. In much the same way that the rebellion of the southern states, you know, the great rebellion of the southern states, which they call that, and we call it, they call it the war against northern aggression, we call it the Civil War, resulted in literally a dictatorship during the Abraham Lincoln administration, which was then continued through Reconstruction, a dictatorship for the South. And no matter how exalted its reasoning, it set the whole country back 45, 50 years. And it was done by something that was then called the Union. So, and I'm not supporting the cause of the South. I'm just saying that they blew it. They got up and walked away because they lost their political power, and the result was a war that they thought they could win, and they just happened to be wrong. So we don't want that to happen again because it set the whole country back. To be specific, if those who demand gun control laws be put in place by executive order had so much support, why can't they elect a majority to Congress? Why is it that Congress refuses to pass, and not just Republicans, refuses to pass these draconian gun control laws? The reason is people want to be able to protect themselves, and Democrats and Republicans agree with that. If the Bundys out in Oregon are so hell-bent on demanding liberty and using waving their guns around to protect liberty— why haven't they run for Congress? I mean, they come from relatively rural districts with lots of other ranchers and farmers. Why hasn't Cliven Bundy run for Congress? Is it possible that he doesn't have the support that he thinks he has? If shadowy business councils believe so strongly that they act in the best interests of the community, like the Itasca group, why are they so afraid to discuss these issues in public and run for office and debate them openly? If Black Lives Matter is so correct about the violence perpetrated by the police as racism, why is crime of all kinds most pronounced in Black majority communities? And how would they answer that question if their representatives ran for city council or state legislature, which they should? But is there enough support to elect them in their own communities? So here's our problem. The people operate best when left alone to exercise their sovereignty in their communities. In other words, whether it's business, social interactions, solving problems, we can generally solve problems on our own. Now, sometimes we do need refereeing and officiating, and this is where government can be good because sometimes that's what has to happen. But here, what are our problems that we're trying to address in this society today? First of all, our economy is slow and people are frustrated and angry. They're not growing their businesses. They're not earning more money. They don't feel that things are getting better. They think the country's on the wrong track and they're taking it out on their brothers and sisters. I mean, that's basically what's going on. And I think, personally, it's because there is too much government intervention and it distorts the economic and social processes because government officials and people who are unelected and believe they are princes act in what they consider to be the people's best interests at best and their own interests at worst. Tax dollars are appropriated and spent profligately. I don't think that's an argument, whether it's for people spending money in the military to put things in a warehouse or it's to spend things on you know, programs that don't really do anything. Just as an aside, very quickly today I saw a story that the president has not filled many positions in the executive branch because he's going to be leaving in a year and he doesn't want to go through the confirmation process. And this guy was lamenting the fact that there are all of these executives who are acting instead of fully vetted and appointed by Congress. And I interpreted that to mean apparently there's a lot of people at these agencies that are unnecessary and they should be laid off. because they seem to be able to operate quite effectively. The Interior Department seems to be operating quite effectively without someone at the top. The Treasury Department seems to be operating quite effectively without someone appointed by Congress at the top and middle managers kind of running things. I mentioned the tax dollar thing. Here's a good one. Winners and losers are decided upon in secret with complex regulations issued by executives pushing out against legislatures. And you need to hire attorneys at great expense to figure it out. And if you can't do that, then you're a loser. Political winners will naturally sing the praises of these overreaches, and the losers are relegated to protest and anger. I think that's something that needs to be addressed, and the way that you address it is through development of political power. And then we have panels of unelected nobles given control over business and people's lives with little or no oversight. The fact that they actually are able to function without causing more problems is amazing to me. There are a lot of decisions that should be made by elected bodies, and they are left to the courts, which have no choice but to split the baby. All too often, courts assume executive prerogative, writing law and enforcing their own law when they should be interpreting it or deciding cases based on the merits of the available fact and logic of arguments for and against. The negative effects are observed on both ends of the political spectrum. This is a huge source of frustration and anger in the United States. It is not going to be solved by a new president. It is not going to be solved in one election. These are the kinds of problems that can only be solved by the people. And as we do not solve them, they will get worse every year. Now, the good news is we're heading into a great age of technology that has already eroded centralized power. The bad news is people are increasingly unlikely to support anything that appears deliberative or doesn't rely on lurid emotional outrage to get reaction and doesn't gin up partisanship. Our media relies on outrage and emotion and personality rather than substance and issues, coverage, or real journalism, which I refer to as essentially assembling the facts to tell a story, advancing the story, and illuminating the issue for people on all sides. So this generation has the choice of seeing its republic descend into a facsimile of failed democracies run into the ground by mobs, whether it's Argentina or Brazil or Rome or ancient Greece or, France, the French Revolution. It doesn't matter whether it's ancient or current times. It could happen here. A renewal of the roots of liberty is also possible, and a limited government that protects the rights of the individual and encourages liberty and builds a base for the development of the greatest age of man yet, an age that really utilizes these new technologies and encourages the development of new technologies without fear, that allows us to build really the greatest age yet on this planet, and certainly the greatest growth of the greatest country yet on this planet. The choice is ours. Got to do a shout out for the digital sponsor, the Bob Davis Podcast, for this month. If you're a pilot and you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings, Alpha Systems makes something called the Angle of Attack Indicator. Bottom line is Alpha AOA saves lives. And you can click on the Alpha Systems banners for more information. It'll take you to their site, the Alpha Systems banners at the top of the BobDavisPodcast.com. It will take you to their site and it will give you more information about Alpha's revolutionary Angle of Attack Indicator. All right, don't forget that the ex-government truck's Mega Truck Center is now open at 356 19th Street in Forest Lake, or you can call 763-777-8782. Bottom line is they have tons of these really cool fleet-maintained former government vehicles, Ford, Chevy, Dodge, Toyotas. They still have the great ex-government cars, the Crown Vic, which I've had three of, the Dodge Chargers, and the Ford Police sedans. They also have the three-day peace of mind guarantee. Ed and the guys are always willing to help. And of course, when it comes to lending, they can get all levels of credit approved. And there are tons of help on that front. So I can't say enough about ex-government trucks. And of course, that's where the Mobile Podcast Command Center came from. And I still love my 2000 Super Duty diesel ambulance.
Exgovernmenttrucks.com.
Also, don't forget that the polar vortex is coming, and that might cause you some plumbing issues, especially with the heating and the cooling right now. Don't forget Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul for emergency service, 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. They go metro-wide from St. Paul, and that means the suburbs too. Ryan Plumbing and Heating for four generations, quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems. And again, thanks, Greg, for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcast. All right. Thanks to you guys for listening on Stitcher.com, iTunes, the granddaddy of podcasts, or TuneIn, or Google Play, or BlogTalkRadio.com, and for listening to the new radio show at GCNLive.com, the Bob Davis Podcast Radio Show. Thanks for your donations for Mobile Podcast Command. We are counting down the days before I head south down to Iowa and points east and south to cover election 2016 as it heats up in those very first few days of the primary season. And thanks for liking and sharing and favoriting on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And thanks again for your donations at thebobdavispodcast.com. Thanks for listening to podcast 453. Just some crazy thoughts about new thinking in the middle of the night.